KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. In 1979, Playboy magazine published an interview that nobody expected to see and basically changed the world of print journalism. It certainly changed me. It's one of the biggest influences on my career in, you know, to the extent that I have a career. Anyway, sitting across from me is a man who made that interview happen, Lawrence Grobel, who's got the rights back to that and has been published as Conversations with Brando. Larry, it's always good to have you here.
Oh, it's great to be here, Elvis. Good to see you. You're looking good.
Not as good as you, but just reading this again and having to pour through last night, first of all, I still can't put it down, but the postscripts, I mean, just to be reminded of, first of all, in reading the interview, there's a sense that I never get in most interviews, which is he was completely in the moment all the time you talk to him, which is also his gift as an actor, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And what was interesting with Marlon is Marlon was as interested in me and in my life stories than as I was, really. And it was striking to me because I have interviewed thousands of people, and very few of them are interested in you. If you talk to Ray Bradbury, and if you got off subject off of him, his eyes went blank. That's it with a lot of people. Marlon, though, was different. And I ended up judging actors as I interviewed them, you know, as compared to Marlon, about how and how interested he was. One of the reasons he was interested in, I realized later, was he was going to be playing George Lincoln Rockwell in Roots. And Alex Haley was the interviewer. So he was doing a Playboy interview with me, and I realized he was studying me, you know, as I was interviewing him, which is what he did. He studied people. He loved to look at people. He drew. He was a rare person in that regard. I mean, he called me up maybe a year and a half after our interview. And I have it on, because I wasn't there, so it was on the machine, and so it's recorded. And it says, it's Marlon Bumbles, he would say. Or something. He says, you know, I was just thinking about that story you told me about when you got, you know, arrested when you were a kid and you were standing there asking for an apology from the, he says, cracks me up. And he hangs up, you know. Nobody else does that, right? I mean, you know, it's like he's sort of was like a real sponge, and he could take in from all these different people. And that's why he was able to create the characters, I think, that he created.
Well, one of the things I want to ask you, too, because you're in a unique position having spent time with both Brando and Truman Capote,
yeah,
whose famous New Yorker profile sent right. Brando into hiding.
The Duke in his domain, yeah.
Yes, and he was, Brando, I found in talking to you about, was particularly generous, much more generous, in fact, than I thought he would have been.
Well, you know, Marlon told me that when Capote was coming to see him, he staged the whole first meeting. So he put papers down all over the floor, and he put his, like, script. So it looked like he was, so when Capote wrote it, he's right, he describes this. And Marlon was laughing to me. He says, yeah, I just throw everything around. I said, that was the impression I was going to make on him. He goes, so, I mean, these were two characters. Capote was a great character. Marlon was a great character. And, you know, when I first met Capote, it was at Le Petit Montmartre, a French restaurant in New York opposite the UN building, and he lived in the UN towers. And he was sitting, he was there before me, and he had a very large head. You know, he was a small man, but he had a big, but the feeling I got when I met Capote was Brando. You know, I mean, it was almost like, I mean, two very different looking guys and everything.
But the same kind of physical presence?
Yeah, there was a powerfulness in the two of them that, you know, it was just there. So, you know, I just found that interesting.
And the same level of concentration, because the one thing when rereading the piece, which I didn't need to, because I basically have the Brando interview memorized, but from reading it again, his concentration in a room.
Yeah.
Was it power in and of itself? Was
it
not?
Because, you know, I'd ask him about, you know, how do you, is it that you just can't memorize the things anymore? You have to put stuff on the side of somebody or on the forehead, you know, to get your lines that way. And as we're talking, all of a sudden he's reading, he's just giving me book titles and one after another. And he was at my house at the time, and he was looking at the bookshelf above me, and he was naming every book on the first two shelves while still talking and looking straight at me. And it was a real lesson in acting. And he says, I'm looking at everything. Does it change anything to you? Do you don't think, you know? And it was like, yeah, the guy knew how to do that. You know, it was pretty interesting. But he was in the now. It's a very good description of, you know, who he was. He lived in the now, Brando. And, you know, when I first got the assignment, I got a call from Playboy. And I remember Barry Golson was the editor at the time, and he calls me. He says, Larry, are you sitting? He says, are you sitting? And I said, he says, okay. He says, we've got a very big assignment. He says, Marlon Brando owes Hefner a favor because he bailed Russell Means out of for $50,000. So they knew we'll never get the money back. He said he'd write an article. He's never going to do it. So Hef said, would you sit for an interview? And he agreed. Now, I was young for Playboy at the time. I had only done Henry Winkler, Dolly Parton, and Barbara Streisand. I had done three interviews. And I always wondered, why did they give me this assignment? Because this was a big assignment. And because Streisand was big. I mean, that was already big. But Brando was that next level of the thing.
Streisand did the cover of Playboy.
Yeah, Bobby did the first cover. And I can tell you a whole story about that, but that's another meeting. But with this one, they said, well, you showed a lot of patience with Streisand. I didn't get paid for I was with Barbara for 9 months doing one interview, and I never got a dime out of Playboy until it was published. So I was still young, and I was aggressive, and I had ambitions, and money meant nothing. It was just getting to reach the pinnacles of this particular profession, which would be interviewing. And I was curious about this profession. I was writing articles, and I said, okay, I started doing this. It just one thing happened after another. And I knew Brando was it. If I can succeed with Marlon Brando, then okay, I've reached an understanding of what this form is all about. And I prepared. I mean, it went on for, and the reason I said, because I showed that with Streisand that I had patience. And they knew this was going to take patience, because from the assignment, it still took something like 17 months to get to Brando, because it kept getting delayed. And I was dealing with his secretary, Alice Marshak, and I had a great relationship with her on the phone. And she
said something really interesting to you at one point, which kind of explains it all. He knows what he doesn't want. Yeah. He doesn't know what he wants.
Right, right. And she was great. She gave me a lot of good material. So she actually told Marlon, she said, why don't you do this in Tahiti? Because he kept putting me off. He had one thing after another going on. So when he called and he says, hey, listen, Larry, first of all, he wanted my questions, and I didn't want to give it to him. He says, I'm better off now. Because I don't want to talk about the Indians. I want to talk about the Indians. I don't want to talk about acting.
Prepared a letter, in fact, to respond.
I gave him. He said he wanted the questions. I said, I can't give you the questions, Marlon. I hung up and I said, oh, I was really upset because I thought I blew the interview already, which is from the phone call. So what I did was I sent him a list of five or six things. And I said, Marlon, I don't know what the questions are going to be, even though I'm writing questions after questions. He says, but here are the topics I'd like to cover. You know, one, women; two, men; three, culture; four, you know, environment, you know, and five, you know, acting of whatever. But it was like the broadest things I could possibly come up with. And he didn't get it. You know, that wasn't good enough for him. But then finally he called and said, okay, just come. And so then he says, what was that thing you sent me? I said, it was just the fact that I couldn't just agree to do the Indians with you. I will talk to you about Indians as long as you want, because I prepared 400 questions. I read books. I read congressional records. I mean, I was so prepared for the Indians that my whole thing was I was going to out-Indian Marlon Brando. I knew so much about it, right? And so, and what really struck me was how much he knew. Because I did ask a lot of those questions. We spent 6 hours the first day, and I just talked about the Indians. And the next 2 or 3 hours the following day, I talked about the Indians. And finally, when I would throw in something like about the scene from On the Waterfront, so he would get into it for a while, and then he would catch himself. And he'd say, oh, you got me. You got me right in the bush. You got me talking about acting. And that's what this interview became. This interview is really the most cat and mouse interview of any I've ever put into print. And I remember Arthur Kretschmer, who was the executive editor of Playboy, said he thought it was the best interview Playboy had ever published. And that was some compliment because, I mean, I grew up reading Playboy interviews. But what's interesting about this interview is that cat and mouse game that's going on throughout. I mean, as you see, I'm trying so hard to get him to say something, and he's not going to say it. And then finally I get him to do it. And then you realize, and you're reading this as it's happening. You know, it's like that. Of course, it was edited. You know, I mean, I had a lot of work with it. So Al Pacino agreed to talk to me because I was the guy who did Brando. And I was his first big interview. And he told me that he carried around, he showed me that he carried around a Xerox of the Playboy, the interview with Brando in his pocket. He, you know, and so when I finally put it out as a book, you know, I did it in a sense that for him, I said, here, you can have a book now. You don't have to just, you know, but it was one of those times, Elvis, when you've interviewed a lot of people, you know, probably as much as I have, maybe even more, I don't know. But the assignment was different this time. I was very cool on the phone. I said, Brando, I said, great, that sounds great. I'll love to do it. I hang up the phone, and I don't know who I called first. But I gonna do Brando's, that kind of thing. And I became crazy. I started to, you know, think, what am I gonna do with him? He's gonna see right through me. You know, he's at a great, I think we can say detector, but that's what he had. And I knew that. The better the actor, the more they can see into you. And so I figured, I can't bull with Marlon. I'm going to have to know what I'm talking about. Like, you know, and so I was nervous. I was really nervous about all this. And I said, the only way to overcome the nerves is to be so prepared that he can't surprise me in any way. So I'm preparing by reading everything, by seeing every movie, by thinking about this, by going into the mirror in my bathroom and asking questions to my own face, you know, and see, you know, and it was like, you know, so I became like a crazy person in a way. And my, you know, my girlfriend at the time, is now my wife, she kept saying, you know, why are you acting like this? You know, he's only an actor. And I go, only an actor? And Picasso was only a painter? I said, you know, Joyce was only a writer. It was that kind of obsession. So when I finally get there, and I, you know, after so many times of yeses and nos, and I get off I go to Papiette, and then I go to Teotihuacan, which is 40 miles away, and it's about 40 minutes. I get off the plane. I'm with, by the way, Tarita and Cheyenne, who's 5 years old, on the plane. I don't talk to
his
them,
wife
just
and daughter.
Them, right?
Yeah.
And I get off, and there's Marlon. It's like an interview with God in a way, you know. I mean, it's like you're finally going to talk to somebody, and you're going to be tested in a lot of ways. And he picks up my bag, and he walks me to the bungalow where I'm going to be. He looks down at my sandals, and he says, "Well, you're wearing the wrong kind of sandals." I said, "Oh, why?" He says, "Well." He says, because of the way the sand's going to get into that, you know, he says, you know that the Indians, I mean, the locals, the natives, you can tell a person's education by the spread of their toes, because those whose toes were really spread wide were barefoot, you know, and they never, you know. So anyway, that's the kind of guy he was, though. He had all these little observations, all these things about flies and how fast they're going and looking at the, you know, looking down how, if you took a straw and you wanted to suck up water from the, you know, from the sea, how far down could you? He had all of these arcane little things. And it was fascinating. It's just being around someone who always was entertaining and not boring and thinking about things that were serious, you know. So, I mean, when we got into the Indians, and I thought I would read a little bit of sections from Marlon talking, because just to give people an idea of his passions. He was a great actor. He did five of his first five or six movies were as good as any, you know, debut of any
Absolutely.
Actor.
Absolutely. I'm going to ask you, we can take a break here, yeah. So we can come back, have you read something from your great collection. Finally, well, although this is the second time, but anyway, the book is, of course, Conversations with Brando. My guest is Lawrence Corbell, a man who found out that Brando knows that a fly goes at 22 miles per hour. It's the treatment. We'll take a break this morning. Come stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. I'm honored to have you joining me again. It's been 5 years, as you reminded me, is Lawrence Gobel, Larry Gobel. He's published his interview, the extended version of the interview with Marlon Brando. The book is Conversations with Brando. And he's got a section that he wants to read to us right now.
Well, I was looking at the book yesterday, and there's a section, a paragraph, he talks about men and women that to me is very close to the Me Too movement of, you know, now. You know, I mean, and this was done in 1978. There's something on solar energy, you know, that he talks about, and there's also something about silence and the nature of conversation. So, what I thought I would just read first, because I don't know about our time and how much, but this is just a little bit. But when I asked him, what is it is most shocking to you about the Indians? Because the Indians was his biggest cause, and that's really what he wanted to talk about, the American Indians. And he said, what is shocking to me is that we can consistently try to expunge an entire people from this planet and not have the world know the silent execution that has taken place over a period of 200 years. And that this government that we live under, which we all say is wonderful and fall to our knees in worship of, has systematically deprived the Indian of life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and at the same time, screaming around the world like a whistling skank with rabies, that we believe in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How in the world can we do that at the same time that we're strangling the life out of the only native culture that existed on this land? The American government has shot them, murdered them, starved them, tried to break their spirits, stolen from them, kidnapped their children, and reduced them to rubble. That is what shocks and angers me. We lied to them. We chiseled. We swindled. Swindle, swindle, swindle. Nothing less than swindle. Swindle the Indian. And we know now we'll say we did not swindle. We did swindle. We did kill. We did maim. We did starve. We did torture. We did the most heinous things that could be done to a people. We will not admit it. We do not recognize it. It is not contained in our history books. And I want to pull my hair out when I read high school textbooks that deal with the destruction of a people in two paragraphs. I am ashamed to be an American and to see fellow human beings who, if human rights mean anything at all, have every right to the land they live on and more land than they have. Very strong. He was like this for days. I mean, you know, he was, you know, I would ask him about stuff and he would get passionate and he would talk about things. And he knew what the treaties were. And he knew, you know, he could go into detail with what was going on and how he got shot and, you know, in one protest and how he wanted to do he was going to do this thing called The First American. He was doing a TV series. So he, you know, this is all he really wanted to talk about. And for 6 hours, and 3 hours, let's say 9 straight hours, that's all I talked to him about was Indians. And by the time I brought in other things, it was like a relief to him. And then we'd go back to the Indians. And then we'd go back to other things. And that's what this interview became, is that, like, you know, him trying to just talk about it on one subject and me trying to talk about a bunch of different things.
But part of it, too, is he couldn't do that for that long because he just, as you mentioned, and it's clear with anybody who reads this extended version of the interview will see, that he had so many interests that he just couldn't limit himself to one subject. I mean, he could
He
was testing you to a large extent by putting in a working day of talking about the Native Americans. But the fact was, he just had too many interests. Yeah. He was fascinated by too many things to limit himself to one subject. And that's evident from seeing the body of this interview collected like this.
You know, it's interesting, too, is that when this book first came out, I got from two playwrights in London contacted me, both of them wanting to option the book. They thought it would be a good play. And in a sense, yeah, it's two guys talking. It is a good idea for a play. And I thought about it, but I wouldn't let anybody have it yet because I was thinking about doing it. And I thought I'd like to do a screenplay based on it. And then a screenwriter got
in touch. Because you mentioned talking to Brando about a screenplay.
No, that was in the postscript, I was writing a novel, and then I wrote a screenplay, and I told him, it was called Helix, and I told him, you know, the general area, genetic engineering thriller or whatever. And he rolls with it. He just says, oh, right up my alley. And he starts telling me how I can do it and who I should produce it. And you should direct it yourself. And you could, and it's all, you know, and I'm writing notes like crazy. I'm talking, you know, anyway, I write those things because that there's that one phone call that I write about after I'd seen him, after the interview came out and all, that lasted over an hour. You know, it was a long conversation with this man. I felt that, you know, I was able to understand him a little bit. You know, I mean, this was a very complex man, and it was, you're not going to get to him all so easily. But he came to my house once. I was on the island with him for 10 days. We had breakfast every day, lunch, dinner, just the two of us with secretary. Sometime we'd be there. And I went sailing with him. We played chess. He was a much better chess player than I was.
And he told you the great story about Bogart playing chess.
And he says about, Bogart, would never like to lose a chess. And so they once brought in this guy who wasn't really that good, but they put an earplug in him, and they had somebody looking with binoculars from above telling the guy how to move. And the guy beats Bogart. And Bogart got so upset with this guy that he threw up the table with the thing.
My guest was upending the microphone over here. Being so enthusiastic as Lawrence Corbell. His terrific collection, the book with the entire Marlon Brando interview from Playboy, is called Conversations with Brando. You were telling me, too, that I guess there's some movement now about this actually being dramatized.
Yeah. Let me ask you this before I tell this guy. Who do you think today could play Brando at 57? That's when I saw him, and that was right after he had done Apocalypse Now. And so the idea of this screenplay is that it's about this guy who's going to interview God and get, you know, and all the nervousness and all the craziness of this character, and then going finally to this island, and there he is, and then he sees that God has flaws, and it's going to be a cat and mouse type game, and then there's things that happen dramatically. But who would you let me?
Gosh, there's so many people that come to mind. I think about Alfred Molina, who could do, because he has that kind of towering presence, but also that kind of curiosity. And having seen him on stage, Molina at least, but certainly Anthony Hopkins comes to mind, being way too old for it, but certainly somebody like that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Anthony Hopkins wanted to do it, and I had two lunches with him and whatever. And for reasons beyond this conversation, I decided it's not going to be right. And then Rutger Hauer wanted to do it, and he had, read an early version of the script, and he was coming to L.A., and my agent was his agent at the time, and so he said, he'd like to meet you. I said, Rutger Hauer, Blade Runner, man. So he was going to be at Book Soup on Sunset, and there was a little restaurant right next door to it, so he and I met at the restaurant, and he said to me, I just want to tell you that I've read your book, I read the script, and I'm in. If you want me for Brando, I don't know if I'm big enough for an audience, your audience. You're talking to me as if I'm a producer. I'm not. I'm just a writer. So I said, hey, Rutger, you'd be great. Let me see. So I did talk to a few agents about it, and everybody was saying he's not big enough for the stage. You know, and it was and then I saw him at Camera Image Film Festival, and there were thousands of people waiting in line. He sees me, says, and I go upstairs with him, and he says, I still would love to do Brando, you know, like that. So that was nice to at least know that. But I asked Jeff Bridges to read it, and he did. And he called me up, and he said, I know who should do this. He says, it's not for me. He says, I don't quite see doing Brando. But Woody Harrelson is perfect for it. And I never had thought of Woody before. And I said, oh, that's an interesting choice, you know, because he does have the profile. The other person I thought, because takes place on an island. I understand that Bruce Willis has an island. You know, Willis might be interesting. You know, and also, you now have these younger guys who are no longer younger. You know, like Brad Pitt and DiCaprio are both over 50. You know, so it's like anything can happen. The one that I think would be the most dramatic casting, and, you know, I probably shouldn't even mention it because it sounds so crazy, but is Meryl Streep. Because Meryl Streep has always said that she, you know, she's looking for challenges now. She's, you know, this is why she did Margaret Thatcher. This is why she does certain things now. And I thought, what greater challenge for her, our greatest actress, to play our greatest actor. You know, I mean, it would, you know, you can do anything these days with puffing yourself up, fixing your face. So I actually wrote an article, said, could Meryl Streep play Marlon Brando? I did an article for this magazine in Poland, and they published it, you know, on a big thing. And then they put out a book on it, so this is part of it. I'd love to get that to Meryl, but it's all in Polish.
So did you know she ever?
No, I haven't. I mean, listen, if Meryl Streep or Woody Harrelson are listening, or Bruce Willis, this is it. This is because it's a
I wouldn't miss any meals waiting to hear that they're listening to the show. But that's very kind.
Well, you know, this is a good show.
Well, it's very kind of you to say.
It's a good show. We're talking about Elvis. We're talking about
Marlon Brando, two equally famous guys. But it's funny because as we talk about this, though, I just was thinking about the way you describe people in his orbit. The bartender basically was about as sort of commonsensical about this as Brando himself was.
Well, that's the thing. The bartender said, "Oh, I said, do you know who he is?" He was from a German guy, and he says, "Yeah, he's an actor. You're an actor. I'm an actor. We're all actors." And then I asked the woman who worked there all the time, and she was a lovely woman, and she's Tahitian. Did you ever see anything Marlon did? He says, I saw the one on with a streetcar. Yeah, I saw something like
that. The trolley.
The trolley. And trolley, you got it. And he says, very nice. And I saw an Elvis Presley movie, and they're very nice. They're both very nice, like The Godfather and Elvis Presley. It was funny. But yes, he had genuine people around him. You know what I mean? It wasn't they were fawning over
him.
Well,
that's why I was so struck by that. Clearly he was trying to sort of populate his life with people who he could make contact with and engage with in ways that wouldn't have anything to do with his celebrity.
Right. For instance, this guy William,
the bartender.
William was the worker. I'm in this. The hut I'm in had one open window. You know, it was basically a thatch roof thing. So the thing is open with a stick and whatever. The mosquitoes were really terrible at the time, and for 3 days I was suffering. You know, I mean, getting bitten up. I didn't have lotion with me. I didn't say anything. Marlon comes in my room on the fourth night, a day, and he says, mosquitoes getting to you? He must have seen the blotches on my eyes. And I said, yeah. It's good. So he says, William, bring him a net over his bed. So anyway, he puts a net. Now, why didn't he do it the first night, right? That's Marlon. That Marlon was a prankster. He was judging people. He was seeing how long you could take something before you go nuts. That's what he did with even the tape. It took me 3 or 4 days before he let me turn my tape recorder on. So that's why he got to know so much about me, because I wasn't asking him questions until I could turn the tape on. And so Marlon then comes and goes, there's a little stuffy in here, and he tells William, put in three more windows. And he comes with a machete, psh, 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 and within an hour, I got three more windows that are open. It was a very different kind of lifestyle. He peed on in front of his, he urinated on his plants make him grow, which is something that I've done now ever since he told me he did that. So in my backyard, I said, my wife hates it, but I said, well, let me just see if Marlon's right, you know.
And it works?
It works, yeah. It doesn't kill him.
Okay, all right. But I mean, that's, again, the idea that somebody could be that, have that many interests. And also, again, like I was saying when we got started, you never got any sense that he was basically eyeing the clock.
Yeah.
As you do in so many interviews, especially nowadays.
And, you know, we don't have probably a lot of time to go into the tragedies of his life happened.
No.
But when he died, he was 80 years old, and it was in 2004 in June or July, and I was on the golf course, and there was a Korean girl that was playing with me. I didn't know her. She was joined our group, and I was on the 11th hole. My wife calls me up, and she says, everybody's calling you from all the radio stations and everything. Marlon Brando died. And I just it was one of those moments, and I remember I said to the girl, Marlon Brando died, and she said, who? You know, it was just like one of those just, wow, you know. But then I got on, Fox wanted me to come on, and I'm not a big fan of Fox News. I said, look, you're going to do a job on him, and I don't want to be part of the job you're doing on him, because I have a lot of respect for what he did and what he stood for. And they said, no, you can come in and say what you want to say. So, okay, so they try to go off with his relationship with his wife, where he's getting beaten. And I said, look, I said, a great man has just died. I said, you look at what you do when Ronald Reagan dies, and he doesn't even have, couldn't even shine Marlon's boots. Well, that shocked the whole Fox Nation, right? How could I dare compare Ronald Reagan to Marlon Brando when I could easily compare the two?
Well, no, that important. There could have been no better point of comparison than that, when Reagan's even mentioned in the book. Anyway, we're out of time. I can't thank you enough for doing this. But my pleasure to have you back. You know that.
Okay.
You know how much I love you. The book is Conversations with Brando. My guest is Lawrence Gold-Bell. Please pick up the book. It's full of great information. It will make you appreciate acting and the art of the interview. Our recording engineer, who also mixes the show and edits the show, is Kat Yore. She works much harder than I do. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Shake it, don't break it. catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.